We had a great hearing last week with great testimony from the community that developed this plan. And that's really important as a frame of reference. This is a community-built plan supported by the Portland Development Commission, not a PDC plan that someone else has sort of passively signed off on. These are their ideas, and I think they're good ideas. I think this plan is a cause for celebration, not hand-wringing. This is a time when we can take advantage of the development market that we've just been talking about this morning and finally make something happen. Steve, you quoted one song last week. I think we need another brick in the wall here. Actually lay one brick on another in Old Town Chinatown, because at the current rate of development, in about 300 years, we'll build out this plan. So I'd like to see more activity, and that's exactly what this package is intended to generate, and the kind of balance for the neighborhood that they've wanted all along. It's interesting that our next item on the council calendar is a very wonderful project, but a $6 million affordable housing project in Old Town Chinatown. Great. We're good at that. But we need to be good at a number of other kinds of changes in Old Town Chinatown, and that's what this plan is about. So I think all of us are ready to see activity, ready for us to see realization of this plan, and are not content to do nothing and hope. So I'm very excited about this plan. We have had a good discussion about the systems development charge exemption and some good suggestions from council members. So hearing that concern, I want to put on the table a proposed amendment that will allow, that would add five more years of affordability, that is, of incomes up to 120% of median for the 5 years that follow the initial 10-year window for people at 100% of MFI. So I would like to propose that amendment. Council has copies, and if we can get a second for that,
second. We'll
put it on the table. So roll call to put that on the table.
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
I think this is even worse than the original proposal. No.
Hales?
Aye. Okay, amendment's on the table.
Patrick, I'm
did
sorry.
Did you not get the vote?
I think he's a student of the Tip O'Neill School of the Gavel. It's no need to record my vote, but had I been asked, I would have respectfully voted no. But I do have a question, if it's now laid before us.
Okay.
I'm familiar, Patrick, with our 60-year affordability covenants on the affordable side. And by the way, the project we're about to take up in Old Town Chinatown actually has market rate units as part of the mix. But the I'm familiar with locking in 60 years and why we do that. And it's partly to make sure we get a fair public return on the we get a return on the public investment. Why in the additional 5 years would we go up to 120%? And practically, what does that mean to existing tenants if we open it up to 120% in that 5-year window?
Well, first off, I we have one perspective and one set of kind of observations on this. I know there was a lot of conversation among the five of you over the course of the week about this as well. So I think there's other perspectives to add on this. I think what we were trying to do is respond to concerns about this, like 10 years, and then it just opens up. And I don't think any of us can really predict what will happen after that. It could be that, you know, maybe the market is at a place where, you know, rents would just jump. It could be that we're still in the same place we are or have incremental improvements and no restrictions are necessary. But I think we're trying to think about what if after 10 years if there really is an opportunity to raise rents significantly, what would that do? And so this was to provide kind of an additional period of time, a buffer, so that property owners could realize some benefit from rising rents, and you wouldn't have this cliff, but to still provide a time horizon by which the restrictions would be lifted and it would make sense for developers to make use of the SDC waiver now. But I don't think we know that there's a perfect answer to this, to what's the right time horizon. I think this was just an attempt to maybe soften the cliff if in fact we are in a market 10 years out where rents could jump significantly. You do have the, you know, it also does provide protection against existing for existing tenants, so that after 10 years, if there is a rent increase, it would definitely be limited to just going from 100 to 120% or whatever, wherever it is. But truly, like I said, there was conversations among individuals on the council about this as well.
I know you've been talking to developers and looking at pro formas to see, you know, what will actually create the spark that then creates a development. Has this idea of the additional 5 years and the income range been vetted with the development community?
We've had very limited conversations, and the feedback we've had is essentially keep it simple. And it's hard to say, based on the limited opportunity we've had to have discussions, of what time frame becomes a fatal flaw. But it's more of keeping the mechanisms of the program is simplified among tracking requirements over whatever time frame is identified.
And the other thing we did was there was an idea of making it 130% or some other number, but the folks at housing said, look, we track 120% MFI on some units, so let's use a metric that we already use. So we also adjusted it for that reason, just to make the administration of it more simple.
And is there some model that you've used to try to calibrate public investment versus public benefit? We've made a judgment when we put lots of resource. Well, we put not lots in the preservation side. We put a dollar in. It's a 60-year affordability. So in fact, we've demanded 60 years of certainty for very small amounts of investment. Here we're talking about a reasonable amount of investment and substantially below the 60-year threshold. Commissioner Saltzman has spoken very eloquently. He wants to see entry-level workers, certain classifications of employees being able to live downtown. I'm just curious why we don't think this model works with maybe 15 years at 100%.
You can answer that.
I think it would vary significantly by project to project of the amount of SDCs that are waived relative to the time period. And so we didn't have an opportunity to run kind of that analysis over what time capping rents or keeping rents at a reduced rate, are you negating the value of the SDC, the net present value of those dollars? So we didn't have an opportunity to kind of do a sensitivity test on multiple versions, but we were trying to find that balance of what is the public investment relative to when does it no longer become desirable to a developer and when is it no longer providing value.
And once again, I think the context here is very unique. The public benefit, if you will, that we're trying to create through this is the construction of market rate housing units. So we're trying to get to the point where market rate housing units will get built in this neighborhood and create the kind of income diversity that we all believe makes for healthy neighborhoods. We all cited an article last week that suggested that, you know, neighborhoods with high concentrations of poverty have poor outcomes. So we're trying to get income diversity. So we want to get to a market rate dynamic more quickly. So it's a slightly different model than kind of having, you know, this kind of long-term income restriction. It's meant to spur a small amount of activity to get us to a market rate dynamic, knowing that you know, 70% of the units right now are income restricted.
Right.
So we're kind of in this, it's like this, you know, kind of reverse dynamic we're trying to deal with, which I don't think really exists almost anywhere else in the city.
Patrick, one other question, and I was thinking about this morning, and I'm embarrassed to say I don't know the answer. So currently we tax, let's say it's a parking lot or just a vacant piece of dirt. That gets taxed as unimproved dirt, right?
Yep.
It's taxed at an assessed value of whatever unimproved dirt is. If this is successful and someone builds a building on that dirt, then the improvements are now going to be subject to property taxes, correct? And so that new value of that investment is subject, but it's within an urban renewal district. So do those new property taxes flow to you or to the city and county?
Well, it flows to pay off. It's downtown waterfront. It flows to pay off the debt on downtown waterfront, and so it would hopefully accelerate the pay down of that debt. Or in River District, it would be tax increment that would be used for a combination of both paying down existing debt and new borrowing. So it would be, you know, so the analysis that we did and presented to you as part of the urban renewal amendments the timelines we showed you, that's the timeline that would exist. It wouldn't change for when those dollars would free up and come back to the city, the county, the schools.
So if this is successful, it'll generate property tax revenues that will go to PDC to cover debt on the district.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, though, we're not putting TIF into these projects.
I don't think it's precluded, but the intent is, once again, to make the best use of our resources to have TIF kind of focused on working with existing buildings. If these projects can pencil with just a small SDC waiver, then that I think that's a good outcome. So our intent is not to double up, but I just can't predict that we're not going to come across an existing building housing project that brings market rate units on, but it still needs seismic work or something. So it would be that kind of situation where I think there might be TIF in some of those projects.
Well, and this isn't theoretical, and part of my context for believing this is absolutely the right thing to do is I've been to a lot of ribbon cuttings and groundbreakings in the last few weeks, and they're all right outside of the boundaries of this district, but they're inside of one or more urban renewal districts. So, hooray, the new hotel has opened next to Union Station, just outside of Old Town Chinatown. That value will go into this PDC revenue stream to pay off the River District bonds until the River District mm-hmm. is sunsetted. Mm-hmm. We've sunsetted 30% of it, but we haven't. We've still got 70%.
Right, we're spending money on a parcel. You can assume that assessed value is locked
in. That's going on
renewal.
Literally every day. Somebody just broke ground on a new office building in the Pearl District. We're in discussions about other major development projects mm-hmm. just outside of the boundaries of Old Town Chinatown. If this was auditory, there's a roar all around this district and silence inside in terms of private market rate activity that puts new assessed value on the tax rolls. So this is to get maybe just a little bit of sound.
I guess we
500 units worth of sound.
I guess
in this district.
The question of whether we need to prime the pump is not in dispute on this council. The question is what's the tool we use to generate it. And it's interesting. I hadn't thought about this point, but we're asking. We're doing SDC waivers, which means those dollars will not be available for the purposes they were intended if we're successful and get development. But the development will then in turn generate new property tax revenues, which are not contemplated to be used to refund the SDC waivers, but instead to go into the pot to cover other things. So it's in my mind, it's slightly out of whack. I've made my point about color of money and the use of SDCs. I'm not going to continue to dig that hole. I don't have the support of council to change that, but I did previously suggest that an approach would be to either defer SDCs or to have a mechanism where they're reimbursed out of whatever is generated in the project. That's different than saying whether we want development or not. It's saying that we're going to make SDCs whole. I don't have support for that idea either, but I'm at least interested in this idea because this is billed as a test case and as a pilot. And if this is a pilot, I have a particular interest in making sure we've thought through all the implications, because a pilot sometimes migrates.
I would also note that the SDC waivers only apply to the portion of the project that is residential and only the residential units that meet these income requirements.
Right.
So the commercial components of a project going for retail or additional residential units that might be above these income limits would continue to pay SDCs.
Right.
Other questions for staff? Great. Thank you both. Do we have folks signed up to testify on the amendment?
Three signed up, Joe Walsh, Lightning, and Charles Johnson. Would you please come up?
Come on up. Walsh, you're first.
My name is Joe Walsh, representing Individuals for Justice for the Record. We would just restate our objections that we brought up last week and put it on the record. We see the threat that's in this report where it says, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have it in front of me, that they see as a threat social services in the community. Not homelessness, not houselessness, but social services. That, to me, indicates an attitude, like I said last week. Doesn't seem that anybody is interested in taking that out. We heard testimony last week from a woman that said, we wouldn't do that. Yes, you would. Because you steal from the poor, Mayor. You take their blankets. This 5-year, now extended to 10-year in some instances, is going to make a very clean little section of Portland. And the homeless are not going to be welcome here. They say that in their threats. If they can see the threat, why can't they come up with an alternative or a response to it? Why don't the developers, as Mr. Lightning has said, as I said last week also, come up with some money to do something? If you're going to give them tax breaks, why in God's name don't you include, okay, folks, you want these tax breaks, come up with a plan of what we do with the guy that is homeless, is in your hallway, you don't know what to do with him. What do we do, and what are you willing to put up to do it? Nothing in here. You should be ashamed of this. How the hell can you get past that language? Social services is a threat. Salvation Army is a threat. Catholic Charities is a threat. And you're going to just ram this down. Well, let me tell you, we will watch this really closely, and we will bury you if you screw around with the homeless any more than you're doing now. You steal from the homeless, Charlie. How the hell do you sleep at night?
That's a tough one to follow. My name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Think Lab. One of the things I want to stress is that I think we all want to see Old Town, Chinatown developed and improved. And after some of the other speakers last week kind of said, I need to respect the historical value, I need to respect the history, I do agree with you on that. And I do agree with you. And that's why I'm speaking now, is that I have a tremendous amount of respect for the history and the people. But when I look at a building, I see a building. There may be a lot of memories, a lot of history behind that building, who the owners were and the different things they did throughout the city. And I respect that. I respect the history. I'm a real history buff. I love to read everything about the buildings. But I look at the people laying out on the sidewalks and the doorways, and then I look at that building, and I put at the top of the list the people. That is where I focus on. That is what I want to see the most improvement. I look at that person laying in the doorway on that sidewalk, and I say, you know what? I want to see your life improve. I want to see you being provided incentives, some different things to maybe do a little bit better. Do as good as you can. And so I love the history, but I want to take care of the people, and that's my first concern. Now, are we going to have some displacement of people? Do a lot of people maybe want to, you know, let's move the homeless and maybe go to the east side with them? The reality is we need to provide them housing. When you look out on the sidewalks and the doorways and you're in Old Town Chinatown, that is your responsibility. You've been in the neighborhood a lot longer than I have. It's your responsibility to take that in consideration when large amounts of money are going into these buildings and you know that person on that sidewalk in that doorway doesn't even have a chance to get in that housing unit. You know it. I know it. It's not affordable. It's not going to happen. So we need to look at that. You either clear them out of the area or we figure out another type of housing facility to put them in. We have to, if we displace, we have to replace. If the population is higher than the housing units out there, we need to build more. The reality is the people come first. The building is nothing to me but a bunch of brick, a bunch of concrete. And you know what? If you love that building so much, you would have taken care of that building for the last 30 years and not let it go so dilapidated and boarded up. And look at the people sleeping in front of your buildings. Why not try to fix that building up over the years and put them into housing instead of create homelessness by you being a slumlord? You are a slumlord in denial, and that's what creates homelessness. And if you want to think your building is so much better than that person laying on the sidewalk, I disagree with you, and I have no respect for you if that's what you believe in. Thank you.
Thanks. Charles?
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, Charles Johnson. And I might be happy if I'd been more involved in this process, but I do consider myself more familiar than most people with the Old Town Chinatown neighborhood, the huge amount of real estate owned and operated by Central City Concern in that area. Yesterday, and I, just as I was sitting and preparing to make my remarks, I thought about the odd situation we have with an unknown number of people sleeping every night on Burnside sidewalks. The Portland Rescue Mission, the Union Gospel Mission, Right to Dream 2 happened to be in this area. And no matter how many glossy 21-page PDC pie-in-the-sky documents we produce, there's going to be a homeless problem in this city for one economic development area or another until the city's elected leadership finds a solution other than spending police resources on pushing people around from one sidewalk in one development area to another. Some cities have done it without doing a public agency, but in reality, since your goal seems to be to placate developers, you need to tell them to step up to the plate and build yourselves a Department of Homeless Services like the city of New York has, and have emergency shelter space equal to the number of people that are sleeping in Old Town Chinatown. Just send, instead of sending cops out there to push them around in and out of one economic development center, have the police count them, find out who owns the beautiful dirt pile on the east side south of, by the Hawthorne Bridge, set up a public-private partnership, a fully city-run thing, slightly more structured and better with more involved social work management like Right to Dream 2, and don't tell these people that they have to sit and sleep on the sidewalk night after night as pawns of various developers. I know it's a difficult thing to do in the budget, but the problem with this Old Town Chinatown plan and other plans is that you don't accept basic human dignity as the foundation where you start. You have to take the money, you have to squeeze the service agencies, you have to make a place where you have enough beds for homeless people to not sleep on the sidewalk in front of service providers. The service providers are not the problem. We, as a community, are the problem. We're not taking seriously this issue of hundreds of people sleeping in doorways on this particular, at the time, it's currently convenient for us to stick them in doorways on Northwest 4th, Northwest 3rd, but in reality, they need to be in a hygienic, even if it's a tent city, it needs to be someplace with hygiene equipment and food service, accessible to downtown social service areas, and not impairing access through the sidewalks, and people don't want to live by that. We can't change that. Nobody wants to live in a house where they have to step over somebody that's asleep when they come and go at night. So I wish, as I think Commissioner Fritz did with her vote, that we had put more into this plan to actually solve the real problem of desirability and human dignity in a living in our neighborhoods, downtown neighborhoods. Thank you.
Charles, you might want to stick around and testify on the next item, because the next item is a loan of $6,339,093 to develop 52 affordable and 10 market rate units in this neighborhood. $6,339,093. So to characterize the city of Portland as only focusing police on this issue is not accurate.
Thank you. I do have my fingers crossed for that project, and that hopefully it will be successful, and we'll see more. And I know steps are being made, but we can see, you know, I don't even do it myself. I just walk past these people, and I feel sorry for them. But I'm almost scared to say 79 people as I walk from the Burnside Bridge to 6th Avenue, and to know that we have yet to figure out how we're going to get people and money together to get them in a better place.
Charles, one last thought. I'm about to go to Los Angeles, take my daughter to college. There are 50,000 unsheltered people in Los Angeles, 50,000. And the current debate in Washington goes about something like this, $40 billion in our budget at the federal level for housing that meets the needs of people priced out of the market, $200 billion for housing that funds middle income and above through the consequence of the mortgage interest deduction and the property tax deduction, so foregone revenue. We spend $200 billion subsidizing stable housing for middle income people and $40 billion to cover everyone who is priced out of the market. 50,000 people last night slept in a shelter in New York. 50,000 are on the streets in Los Angeles. I think every once in a while it's worth keeping in perspective that in Portland, in the last 10 years, we've moved 12,000 people from the streets to homes, and we put general fund money behind our deeds. It is not enough. But every time people come before this council and blast the council for not doing enough, they are fulfilling a prophecy that Newt Gingrich had when he started underfunding these programs at the federal level, because he knew it would lead to cannibalizing at the local level, and then we would have these kinds of conversations. And we all wish we could do more. I'm proud to be on a council that takes 30% of urban renewal money and puts into housing. I'm proud to be on a council that puts general fund money in housing. But to be honest, the kind of housing that we are trying to solve is a national problem. It is not a Portland problem. And with all due respect, we could take every penny of our budget, and we still can't compensate for the fact that the federal government is not investing the necessary resources to address a national crisis. And that's not. I don't say this because I want you to come before us and give anyone on this panel a pat on the back. You're an advocate, and you'll never be satisfied, and that's why you're effective. But we ought to put it in some context, and we also ought to recognize that the city has a lot to be proud of in terms of its record in this area. But if the federal government doesn't view it as a priority, we, and this is not a heresy, but I'm going to say it for the record, we cannot solve the problem. We cannot. We are Portland. We cannot solve a national problem, and we should stop kidding ourselves. Until this is viewed as a national priority, Portland, Oregon is not going to solve this problem.
Thank you, Commissioner. I do, in my earlier remarks, I mentioned federal and state involvement. We talked about the tragedy of hungry children, and I do regret that I didn't get a chance to point out the federal issue. WRAP Home, the Western Regional Advocacy Project, their documentation always features the fact that basically there was, since Reagan, a federal war on the poor with the unintended or intended consequence of pushing them out on the street. So I'm very glad, Commissioner Fish, that you do raise this issue, that we need to look at the federal funding and tax structures and make sure that more federal money, however we can, gets channeled into places where it used to be, doing what it needed to do. So thank you for that.
That we certainly agree. Thank you.
May I speak?
Yes, please.
So as I see it, there's...
give us your name again, Ben.
Oh, my name is Benjamin Barber. Sorry for that. As I see it, there's three main concerns. One is whether or not you're socializing losses to privatize gains. And I think perhaps having some stipulations on who gets the money, as you've done, is a wise move. I'd like to see more PDC money go to maybe sustainability B Corps that are forming real estate ventures. And then whether or not we need to prime the pump and how best to prime the pump. And I had this idea about basically allowing people who are in big homes, can't afford them, to bring themselves into real estate deals, and that might help with some of that. And then another thing is about the homeless and how to best serve the homeless and where to place them. And I'm reminded of Rawls' theory of justice, which some of you may or may not know about. I see that the reason why having them in the central city core is good because it lowers the consumer price index for their entire budget and allows them to sustain their lifestyle. So their transportation costs will be extremely lower. At the same time, I do understand why they're saying having mixed income and bringing revenue into the area is also important. And it is a fine balancing act. If by promoting more business and promoting more income into the area, you're able to allocate that extra income to those needs of the homeless, that is completely fine and acceptable to me. I also had some speaking at the Zidell property yards. We talked about how to deal with the homeless. There's a large 33-acre property over there. Some ideas that were floated were temporary structures, where it be either shipping containers that were remodeled or even 3D printing concrete buildings in partnership with the university system and Ross Island Sand and Gravel to make wood frame construction last century. I think that there are some innovative solutions to the problem of homelessness, but as Mr. Fish did point out, there's no way that we're going to solve it. And if we do solve it, everyone's going to send their homeless here, and then we'll be back to the problem of trying to solve it again. But I really do appreciate all of your hard work, and that's all. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you both. Anyone else? Then, unless there's further questions or discussion, we're going to move this to second reading.
I have a question, Mayor. That one of the reasons this was the public hearing was last week, excuse me, was that so that all five of us could be here at the vote. Commissioner Fish has mentioned that he's not here next week, so could we please move it to second reading to the vote at a time that we'd all five of us be here?
I think we can do that. What's the date that that's the case, Sue? That work?
Right.
Safe? Okay, then this will be on the second reading calendar for August 6th. Thank you. Okay, next item, please.